Hey, guys. Back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah. And some waves. So we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between Lisa and West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is expertly crafted from natural latex, natural wool, and certified safe foams to elevate your sleep sanctuary and support a greener tomorrow. Plus, every purchase helps fuel Lisa's work with shelters and those in need. Don't put off a good night's sleep any longer. Get a Lisa mattress today for a sound sleep tonight. Visit lisa.com/iHeart. That's LEESA.com/iHeart.
Warning, this podcast contains spoilers for The Dark Knight, the film which we are discussing today.
And 15 also, years old.
15 years old.
But just in case you haven't seen it.
This year. Happy birthday to Dark Knight. And also the Batman trilogy in general, we're probably going to spoil in a big way. So be warned. Hello, my name is Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Rosie Knight.
And welcome to X-Ray Vision, the crooked podcast, where we dive deep into your favorite shows, movies, comics, and pop culture. And we're so happy to be live from the Sirius XM studio here in sunny Los Angeles.
Yes, it was very sunny today, actually. And in this episode, we're going to start with an interview with a guest that we've had before who's rather wonderful, the boy who loved Batman. Batman franchise EP Michael Uslan. He's going to be discussing the making of The Dark Knight and its impact. Then we're going to be talking about The Dark Knight's 15th anniversary retrospective with Joelle Monique and Shea Serrano, multiple New York Times bestseller author. So it's just going to be good times. Lots of Batman. If you don't like Batman,
we're going to be talking about Batman.
it's Batman only today. It's a rare DC episode.
In a significant way today. And coming up next, Michael Uslan. We are so thrilled to welcome back to X-Ray Vision author, comic book writer, and Batman executive producer Michael Uslan. Michael, welcome to the program. Oh, there he is.
There he is.
With just a few of his awards. Michael, welcome.
Hey, thanks a lot, guys.
So nice to have you back. Thanks so much for joining us.
How could I resist somebody wearing a shirt like that?
Neil Adams Batman. It's the way to go. So yeah, 15th anniversary of The Dark Knight. How does it feel 15 years later to be kind of looking back on what was such a game-changing film?
I feel old. One of the most amazing things is that I teach every year. I go back to Indiana University's media school and I teach two courses on the business of producing motion pictures and experiential learning live from Hollywood. And, you know, it really is from the trenches that we have these discussions. And one of the things that I found is before I start teaching every year, I have to do a little check and look at who my college students are. And at this point, they're all born after 9/11. They are basically too young to have ever seen the Dark Knight trilogy on a big screen in a movie theater. Probably 25% of them do not know who Jack Nicholson was.
Okay.
And probably 10 or 15% don't know from Heath Ledger. That's how fast things change. That's how fast things move out of the public consciousness. Which is pretty amazing when you have to continually change your cultural references as you're teaching. So that's one of the most shocking things about in 15 years, what changes have taken place. But there's one change that has not taken place, and that is the fact that, in my estimation, The Dark Knight may well be the individual greatest, not just comic book movie made, but and this is the real difference. Chris Nolan, the genius that he is, raised the bar for all comic book movies. because I believe for the first real time when someone was walking out of a Chris Nolan Batman movie, such as The Dark Knight, that at last they were able to simply say that was a great film. And that was a moment of elevation, no matter what Marty Scorsese might say. that was a moment of great elevation. And it was pretty incredible. It was a turning point where I believe Dark Knight should have at least been nominated for Best Picture. I can make a really strong argument, I think, why it should have won. But at that point in time, when you consider who the membership of the Academy was, there was basically no way in hell they were going to nominate right. a comic
They had all seen Gone with the Wind in theaters.
But as a result of the massive blowback they got,
yeah,
they changed all the Academy rules. And now that's why you get, you know, 10 mm-hmm. movies nominated at a time. That is the direct repercussion of the Dark Knight omission. Recently, there were a couple of comments. One was by Steven Spielberg, who said Dark Knight may have been the best movie of that year and absolutely should have been nominated, if not a winner. And you had, I'm trying to remember which DP it was, who came out with the statement that that year, best cinematography should have gone to The Dark Knight.
Wally Pfister. Roger Deakins.
Roger Deakins, yeah.
Was it Roger Deakins? Deakins.
Yeah.
Thank you. And it's all very true. It really is very true. So there were a lot of things that changed mm-hmm. as a result of Dark Knight. And I always caution people, if you've not seen the Dark Knight trilogy, please refrain from just finding somewhere on streaming Dark Knight and watching it. Watch Batman Begins. Watch that first, because that will enhance your enjoyment of Dark Knight by at least 40%.
That's the mathematical.
That's the mathematical mind.
Yeah.
I completely agree with you.
And I think Batman Begins is certainly within striking distance of the quality of Dark Knight as well. And they are very highly compatible on a level of mastery of each craft that goes into making a motion picture. So that's always been one of the things for me.
A quick note for all the kids out there, watch the first movie in a series of movies.
You should do
before
it.
You skip to any of the other films. Michael, I wonder if you, because it is such an incredible story, if you could kind of summarize your involvement with Batman on the big screen. How did you come to be an EP of Batman films writ large?
Now, we have to let everybody know I did not pay you to ask me this question.
We can't talk to you and not ask it. Like, it's such a good story.
Because right now, my mentor and friend Stan Lee is whispering in my ear, Michael, great opportunity. Go for the plug. Go for the plug. So that my whole story has been recounted in my memoir, The Boy Who Loved Batman, which is available in trade paperback on Amazon. And I had the pleasure of narrating my own audiobook version for Audible Books of it. And I am very, very happy to announce to you that The Boy Who Loved Batman, my story of it, based exactly on the question you asked, is now being turned into a Broadway play.
Wow.
That's fun.
And it is the Niederlander Organization of New York, which owns like half the Broadway theaters in New York. And we are moving forward like faster than a speeding bullet. And we are headed toward a Broadway debut in due course. And I couldn't be more excited about this. It is a dream come true. And now to give you the quick synopsis.
The
and when I say right quick, that means in less than 3 hours. Number one, I am, and I hope you guys can relate to this, a total comic book geek. My mom said I learned to read from comics before I was 4 years old. I went to the first Comic-Con ever held on the planet Earth in a decrepit, rundown hotel in Lower Manhattan. I was at that first costume parade dressed as the 1940 DC Comics Sandman with the gas mask in a costume my mom helped me make. I like to think maybe that was the birth that night of cosplay. And it was an amazing place to be. It was an amazing time. And while I was there, very few pros came to the first Comic-Con. They were afraid. Stan Lee was petrified. He goes, "You mean there's going to be adults there that read comic books?" They thought they were going to be filled with psychopaths, social misfits, and sociopaths. The only ones who had the nerve to show up, Stan sent his secretary, lovely Flo Steinberg. She was there. And Steve Ditko popped in briefly. And this one guy who I was introduced to by my mentor into the world of comic books, Otto Binder. Now, if you don't know who Otto Binder was, you need to. Otto, in the 1940s, created the Marvel family. Co-created the Marvel family, specifically created Mary Marvel, Black Adam, and went on after Captain Marvel was sued out of existence by Superman. He went over to Mort Weisinger, who was the editor of the Superman comics, where Otto co-created Supergirl, Brainiac, Krypto, and the Legion of Superheroes. So he's a name worth knowing. Otto said to me, "So boys, I was with my friend Bobby. We were 13. He said, are you going to the costume masquerade tonight?" I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Well, who are you getting dressed up as?" And Bobby said, "I'm going to go as the Shadow." And this guy next to Otto goes, "Well, boys, you know, the Shadow was the number one influence on the creation of Batman." And we said, "Wow, we didn't know that." And with that, Otto turned to me and my friend Bobby and said, "Fellas, how would you like to meet the creator of Batman?" And our jaws dropped. We said, "Yeah." He said, "Michael, Bobby, meet Bill Finger." And that was the first of two conversations I had with Bill Finger, who it took years and years of hard work by Mark Tyler Nobleman, Athena Finger, and a lot of people before we were all able to work to get him credit as a co-creator of Batman. And I felt having been, I may be the only person left standing who actually met and talked with Bill Finger. Mm-hmm. And to see him get his name up there is astounding. I mean, it's so important. It really is. So what a way to start my convention. By the time I was 18 and graduating high school, I had over 30,000 comic books dating back to 1936, filling my dad's garage. he never once got his car into the garage. And I was always looking for a way to make comic books my passion in life, my thing. How could I wind up working in the comic book business? What can I do? And I was always looking a way to get for me to get my foot in the door. So I'm at Indiana University, and I'm beginning my junior year. And they started an experimental curriculum department. And they said, anybody, including undergrads, if you have an idea for a college course that has never been taught before and could get the backing of a department on campus, you then would have a right to appear before a panel of deans and professors and pitch your course. If the dean approves it, you can teach it on campus for up to 3 hours of credit. And I thought, oh, my God, you know, nowhere on the planet Earth has anyone ever had a college course on comic books. But why not? Comic books are a legitimate American art form, as indigenous to this country as jazz. Comic book superheroes are a modern day mythology. It's contemporary folklore. And I went to the folklore department and spoke to one of my folklore professors. And I said, "Professor, the Greeks called him Hermes. The Romans called him Mercury. I call him the Flash. The Greeks called him Poseidon. The Romans called him Neptune. I call him Aquaman." And he said, "Michael, you know, you're really right. These comic book superhero stories are the same stories from ancient folklore. It's about brave heroes battling the demons and dragons of their day. I will back you. So armed with that, I went before the dean in the first pitch of my life. I was wearing a Spider-Man t-shirt and a bunch of comic books under my arm. I walk in the door of this room and the dean looks at me from across his conference room table. And he says, so you're the fella who wants to teach a course on funny books at my university? I knew I was in deep trouble. I then launch into my pitch. He lets me speak for 2 minutes and cuts me off. He said, Mr. Uselin, please. He said, stop. He goes, look, I read comic books when I was a little boy. I read every issue of Superman I could get my hands on, but all comic books are cheap entertainment for little children. Nothing more, nothing less. I reject your theory. This, folks, was a life-changing moment for me, because I could have bowed my head being rejected and picked up my funny books and turned around and walked out of the room. But instead, figuring I have absolutely nothing to lose, I stood my ground and I said, may I ask you two questions? He said, ask me anything you want. I said, are you familiar with the story of Moses? And he looked at me like I was out of my mind. And he said, yeah, so? I said, so Dean, could you very, very briefly just summarize for me the story of Moses? And with that, he sat back in his chair, he folded his arms, he goes, Mr. Uselin, I don't know what game you're playing here, but I'll play this with you. The Hebrew people were being persecuted. Their firstborn were being slain. So a Hebrew couple placed their infant son in a little wicker basket and sent him down the River Nile. There he's discovered by an Egyptian family who raised him as their own son. When he grows up and learns of his true heritage, he becomes a great hero to his people. I said, stop. That was great. Thank you so much. I said, Dean, before you said you read Superman comics when you were a kid. By any chance, you remember the origin of Superman? He said, of course, the planet Krypton was about to blow up. A scientist and his wife placed their infant son in a little rocket ship and sent him to Earth. There he's discovered by the Kents, who raised him as their own son. When he grows up and then he stops, stares at me for what I swear to you was an eternity, and says, your course is accredited. I am now the world's first college professor of comic books. And that was amazing, step one. Step two took place 1 hour later. When I got back to my apartment, I was so excited, I called my mommy in New Jersey. And my mom said, well, Michael, this is really, really great. She goes, but you know, if you don't market your work, if you don't market yourself, nobody will ever know about any of your creative wares. I said, Ma, I just turned 20. I'm in Bloomington, Indiana. I have no money. What am I supposed to do about marketing myself? She says, you're a smart boy. You'll think of something. So figuring I had absolutely nothing to lose, I picked up the phone and I called United Press International, which back then was as big a news syndicate as Associated Press is today. I asked to speak to a reporter. This man gets on the phone and I start to scream at him. I said, what's wrong with you? You're not doing your job. You're supposed to be the watchdogs of our society. This is outrageous. He said, calm down, sir. What are you talking about? What am I talking about? Are you kidding me? I just heard there's a course on comic books being taught at the university. Are you telling me as a taxpayer in this state, they're using my money to teach our kids comic books? I said, this has got to be some communist plot to subvert the youth of America. And I slammed down the phone. It took this guy 3 days to find out if IU really had a course like this. And if so, who was teaching it? He shows up at my doorstep with a photographer, interviews me. The interview goes out. It's a third of a page long. It's picked up by virtually every newspaper in North America, a bunch in Europe. My phone starts ringing and never stops. I'm invited on radio and TV talk shows. Every class I teach is filled with television cameras and reporters. 2 weeks go by and I get two interesting phone calls. The first one, it's an exuberant male voice. Hi, is this Mike Uselin? Yeah. Hi, I'm Mike. This is Stan Lee from Marvel Comics in New York City. And that was my burning bush moment because I was talking to my God. I couldn't believe it. And Stan says, Mike, everywhere I look, I'm seeing you on TV. I'm listening to you on the radio. What you're doing is great for the whole comic book industry. How can I help you? That's the day Stan Lee turned from my idol to my mentor and ultimately to my friend. 2 hours later, another call. Mr. Uslan, my name is Sol Harrison. I'm vice president of DC Comics in New York. We've been reading about you in newspapers and magazines. We think you're a very innovative young man. We'd like to fly you to New York City and talk about ways we might be able to work together. Holy, you fill in the blank. Comic book geek, dream come true. I'm offered a job at DC Comics. I can work there in the summers and they'll put me on retainer while I'm back at Indiana finishing up. Can't believe it. Hey, am I going on too long?
No, it's a great story.
It's a great story. You keep going.
Being at DC is a direct line. Yeah, being at DC is a it's a direct line to becoming.
It would be like starting
EP
at the Dark Knight rather than
then
Batman.
Then Batman Begins.
X-ray Vision will be back.
Tired of restless nights? Meet Lisa, the sleep experts. Here at Lisa, we know that good sleep is essential for mental, physical, and emotional health. That's why their mattresses are made for exceptional comfort and support, catering to every sleep need. Check out Lisa's Sapira Hybrid Mattress, named Best Hybrid Mattress 5 years running. Sleep hot? The Chill Collection is built with cool-to-the-touch top fabric and layers of high-density comfort foams, all intended to remove excess body heat while maximizing comfort. With Lisa, getting a new mattress has never been easier. Delivery is free, and you have 100 nights to try out your mattress in the comfort of your home. Don't spend another night dreaming of better sleep. For a limited time, save up to $700 off select mattresses plus 2 free pillows. Go to lisa.com/iHeart for an additional $50 off mattresses and select goods. That's leesa.com/iHeart. Exclusions apply. See lisa.com for more details.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
And we're back.
So my first day, it's like almost 6 o'clock and time to go home, time to head back to New Jersey. When I hear yelling and screaming coming from down the editor's hallway, I go, it sounds like somebody's being murdered. I go running down there. It was Denny O'Neill, one of the great editors and one of the greatest writers in the history of comics. And at that time, Denny, you might recall, was editing one comic book that I was in love with, The Shadow, that Mike Kaluta drew. It was amazing. So I go, Denny, are you all right? He goes, no, I'm not all right. I go, what's the matter? He goes, they had canceled The Shadow due to poor sales. They just got a report in that the latest issue spiked in sales, so they uncanceled it. But they still have me on the same production schedule, which means I must have a script in by the end of the day tomorrow in order to meet the printing schedule. I said, is that bad? He says, it's terrible. He says, I don't have a shadow script. He said, Michael, I don't have a shadow story. I don't even have an idea for a shadow story. I raised my hand. I go, Denny, I have an idea for a shadow story. He said, you do? I didn't. But so what? I saw that door open, that little crack, and I just shoved my foot in. So they said, all right, come in, sit down. What's your idea for a shadow story? The wheels are turning. I just got back from Niagara Falls with my girlfriend. And all the shadow stories were set in the 30s and 40s. And back then at Niagara Falls, people were walking across the falls on a tightrope. And they were going over the falls in barrels. I said, so picture this. late at night, tightrope over Niagara Falls, searchlights going, the shadows battling a villain on that tightrope over the falls. He said, that's a great visual. That'll make a great cover. But Michael, what's the story about? I said, oh, well, I was just about to tell you. The story is about smuggling. What are they smuggling? Well, Denny, they are smuggling drugs. He goes, well, Michael, every story has to have a creative take to it. What's going to be creative that makes this different than any other smuggling story? I said, I'm so glad you asked me that, Denny, because this is the best part, and I've been saving it for last. They were going over the falls back then in barrels, false bottoms in the barrels. They're putting the drugs in that. They go over the Canadian side. They wash up onto the American side. That's how they're getting it through. He said, now that's creative. I like that. He said, can you have a full script on my desk tomorrow night at 6 o'clock? I said, not a problem. He said, go do it. I'm now a writer for DC Comics. I turn in the script that next day at 6 o'clock. I pulled an all-nighter. And 2 weeks later, I'm walking down the editor's hallway. And who's coming toward me but Julius Schwartz. Julie Schwartz, arguably the most important editor in the history of comics, who was responsible for, I hope everyone knows, returning Batman to his darker roots after the TV show went off the air, bringing in Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams to do the job, and Nerv Novik. Julie Schwartz, who gave us the Silver Age Flash, Green Lantern, Justice League, Hawkman, Adam, list goes on and on. And Julie was a gruff guy. Once he got to know, he was a marshmallow, but he could be gruff. So he sees me coming down the hall. He goes, hey, kid. I go, yes, Julie. I read your Shadow script. You did? Yeah. It didn't stink. Whoa, thank you. Thank you so much. He said, how'd you like to take a shot at writing Batman? Oh my God, I still get the chills. It was a dream I had since I was 8 years old. Because when I was eight, I was the boy who loved Batman. More than any other superhero, primarily because of several things. Number one, he had the most primal origin you could imagine. Number two, he had the coolest car in the world. Number three, he had the greatest villains. But most importantly, he had no superpowers. In my heart of hearts, when I was 8 years old, I totally believed that if I worked out really hard, if my dad bought me a cool car, I could be this guy. So my dream was to someday write Batman comics. And now it had come true. When my first issue of Detective Comics came out, through the tears, admittedly, I panicked. I said, oh my God, I've had this dream since I was eight. I don't have a dream anymore. I need a new dream. It took 10 minutes for the epiphany to hit. I remembered back to a cold night in January 1966. It was a night I was a teenager I had been waiting for months. It was the debut of the Batman TV series. I turned it on. Oh, look at that cool animation. It kind of looks like Bob Kane, Jerry Robinson art. Oh, it's in color. Oh, they're spending a lot of money on the sets. Wow, the Batmobile looks cool. 20 minutes in, it hits me. Oh my God, this is a comedy. They've made a joke out of Batman. The whole world is laughing at Batman, and that just killed me as a fanboy, especially one who had already met Bill Finger and was told personally how Batman was created and what he was supposed to be, which was a Dark Knight, actually originally a Dark Knight detective, and not this campy, pot-bellied, pow-zap-wham interpretation doing the Bat-toosie, et cetera. So that night downstairs in my den, I made a vow. I made a vow like young Bruce Wayne once made a vow. Yeah, except he made
similar serious circumstances as
similar.
Well.
Similar.
serious circumstances, but he made his vow over the slaughtered bodies of his parents. Yeah. My parents were safe in the kitchen. But I said, somehow, someday, I am going to show the world the true Batman. The Batman they created in 1939 is a creature of the night who stalks deeply disturbed villains in the shadows. And I will find a way to remove from the world culture these three new words, pow, zap, and wham. But what do you do when you're a blue-collar kid from Jersey? You don't come from money. You can't buy your way into Hollywood. My pop was a stonemason. My mom was a bookkeeper. I didn't know anybody in Hollywood. I had no relatives in Hollywood. So how do you get there from here? How do you jump the Grand Canyon? And that was the dilemma. So what happened was I went back to Saul Harrison one day and I said, Saul, I want to buy the rights to Batman. And he said, Michael, don't even talk to me about this. If you're interested in buying movie rights, you got to have credentials. Go get credentials. So I finished law school and I wound up going to work immediately for United Artists when it was a major motion picture company. And there the lawyers were put in charge of all the legal, business, and financial aspects of movies as they were being developed. And over a period of just under 4 years, I was put in charge of the first three Rocky movies, a beautiful movie called Black Stallion, one of the best movies ever made called Raging Bull. And for 2.5 years of my life, Apocalypse Now, which was a crisis every single day. They said I was getting the experience of 11 movies just working on that. And we can do 2 hours or 3 hours on that alone. And then I went back to Saul Harrison, who now was not vice president. He was now president of DC Comics. I said, Saul, I have the credentials. I want to go out to Hollywood and make dark and serious Batman movies. And I want to buy the rights to Batman. So Saul looked at me. He was very fatherly toward me. You know, he had mentored me into the comic book business. And he knew how serious and devoted I was to all of this. He looked like the poster from the movie Home Alone. He said, Michael, for God's sake, don't do this. He said, son, don't you understand that when Batman went off the air on TV, the brand became as dead as a dodo? That's a quote. He said, Michael, nobody's interested in Batman anymore. I don't want to see you lose all your money. I said, yeah, but nobody's ever seen a dark and serious comic book superhero movie before. This is going to be like a new form of entertainment. He said, is there any way I can talk you out of this? I said, no. He said, all right, Schmoozle, come on in. That began a 6-month negotiation. Gave me time to find a partner who was my dad's age, Ben Melnicker, who was a legend in Hollywood. He was one of the guys running MGM in its Tiffany years. Ben put together the deals for Ben-Hur, Dr. Zhivago, 2001, A Space Odyssey, Gigi and these musicals. And it gave us time to raise money privately. On October 3rd, 1979, I paid the money, signed the contract, bought the rights to Batman, put it in my back pocket, and went out to Hollywood. I said, this can't miss. This is going to be a slam dunk. How can anybody not see the potential for sequels, animation, toys, games? It's going to be easy. I was turned down by every single studio and mini major in Hollywood. I was told it was the worst idea they ever heard. I was told I was crazy. They said, Michael, you can't do serious comic book movies. You can't do dark superheroes. Nobody's ever taken a TV show and turned it into a movie before. It can't be done. As a result of that, from the time I bought the rights to Batman, till we finally were able to get the first Batman movie made, took 10 years. 10 years of rejection, 10 years of everyone telling you you suck. And let me tell you something. You know, when that happens, you got to look deep inside yourself. It tests your mettle as a human being. You got to go, okay, is everybody right? And I'm just being stubborn? Or do I absolutely, truly believe in this and in myself? And I kept coming up with the latter answer. It would not be until 1986, 7 years in, when this amazing young genius coming out of Disney Animation came into our lives after doing a little short called Frankenweenie. And I got a call from one of the execs at Warner Brothers. They said, you got to see this. We're setting up a screening. This kid's done a movie for us. We have a fine cut we want you to see. It's called Pee-wee's Big Adventure. So I went in to see it. I came out and I said, my God, I've never seen a more creative marriage of direction and art direction in my life. I'd love to meet this guy. So they set up three lunches with me and Tim. And they said, your job is going to be to indoctrinate him into the world of Batman the right way. So I met with him. I brought from my collection either the actual comics or reprints, the Detective 27 through 38 from First Batman, Origin of Batman, Origin of Robin, Batman number one, First Joker and Catwoman. Then I brought in the Danny O'Neill, Neil Adams run. And then I gave them the Steve Englehart, Marshall Rogers run. And I kept him away from Zebra Batman, from Robot Batman, from Genie Batman, and all the crazy stuff. And by the end of those three lunches, I knew this was the guy who could do it. And so did Warner Brothers and everybody associated with the picture. And that's what changed the tide. And the last point about getting to the first Batman movie was that we had two, arguably others, but two real geniuses, Tim Burton and Anton Furst. Mm-hmm. Anton Furst was my dear friend, our production designer, who won the Oscar for designing Gotham City, the Batmobile, and the whole look of the picture. But it was Tim Burton who came up with something I always call the big idea. Why do I call it the big idea? Because this idea of his changed Hollywood forever, changed the comic book industry, and changed the world culture's perception of comic books and superheroes. He said, Michael, if we are going to do the first ever serious superhero comic book movie, this movie cannot be about Batman. And at that moment, I think I just melted into the ground. I go, what are you talking about? He says, Michael, this movie has to be about Bruce Wayne. Ah, epiphany. That's what changed everything. We had to get audiences to believe in Bruce Wayne. And his corollary to that was from the opening frames of the movie. We must get the audiences to suspend their disbelief and believe in Gotham City. Gotham City is the third most important character in this movie. And only if they believe in Gotham City will they be able to believe a guy getting dressed up as a bat and fighting a guy who looks like the Joker. And he was absolutely right. Now, the repercussions of that. Stan was the first one to admit it. I know Kevin Feige would also. That big idea is what opened the door for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. We've all been to see the Iron Man movies. Come on, in truth, shouldn't they be titled Tony Stark? Mm-hmm. Shouldn't the Spider-Man movies really be Peter Parker? It's been the whole key to everything, and that is the genius of Tim Burton. That got us to our first picture. And then there was the interlude, and then there was Christopher Nolan.
yeah, the other pauses, you know.
You'd like me to skip the middle part and jump into
You can listen to our other Michael Uslan episode if you want to find out what happened in between.
Mike, unfortunately, we have all the time.
The time.
But thank you so much for outlining your incredible involvement in what has become really one of the pillars of pop culture today.
Yeah, I mean, these movies don't exist without your passion for them. So we always love to chat to you and hear kind of the...
I so appreciate you folks very, very much because you're schooled in this. You love this. And I love talking to people where we're all on the same page. So I have to admit to you, this whole thing's been a setup where I hogged all the time just so you would invite me back for a second time.
We will do it. The Christopher Nolan era is next.
Yes. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you so much, Mike. Have a lovely evening.
Thanks so much. Woo! Take care.
The great Michael Uslan.
Good.
Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between award-winning mattress brand Leesa and home design favorite West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is the culmination of these two companies' shared values: premium materials, meticulous craftsmanship, and sustainable practices. Made with natural latex, responsibly sourced natural wool, and environmentally safe foams, the Natural Hybrid elevates your sleep sanctuary, indulges your senses, and supports a greener tomorrow. Plus, when you purchase the Natural Hybrid, you're also helping fuel Leesa's work with shelters and those in need. Since 2015, Leesa has donated more than 40,000 mattresses to ensure children and families have a safe place to sleep. Don't put off a good night's sleep any longer. Get a Leesa mattress today for a sound sleep tonight. Visit Leesa.com/iHeart. That's Leesa.com/iHeart.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
And now, please welcome to the stage.
Joelle Monique!
Joelle Monique.
Podcast producer extraordinaire. Culture phenom.
And please welcome to the screens here on either side of the studio, Shay Serrano.
Shay.
Where are you?
In a moment.
Oh, Shay!
Jason, he's showing you up. He's showing you up.
What a wonderful conversation.
Oh, my. He's always such a joy. You just, you could just ask him, you just be like, tell us about Batman.
Also, I would be so much less gracious. If
I would be so.
I'd be like, I was right.
Fuckers. Not just once, but like this man, it wasn't just like, you know, Burton, untested, yeah. Keaton, everyone was angry about that casting. Then you get to Christopher Nolan, who'd made three movies before Batman Begins.
Yeah.
And again, he gets to see it in a totally different way, this kind of dream of like a serious, I mean, obviously, like much more serious than even 89. So, yeah, you're right. He's very gracious and humble about those achievements. When Batman's like, imagine somebody once telling you like, Batman, the brand is dead.
The brand is dead.
As a dodo, and now it's like Batman is the brand.
I'd be mentioning them by name in every area.
I heard people don't like Batman. Batman is so successful. I don't know if you know this. This is a fun fact that I like to. Batman is so successful that for a very long time, if you worked in a comic book shop or if you made comics, they only did sales numbers by the percentage of what you sold compared to what Batman sold. There was no numbers. They would say Batman sold 150,000 copies this week, and you sold 30% of Batman. That was actually how Diamond used to do the Batman numbers. It's like a legendary story. That's how unbelievably popular Batman's been, not just in like movies, but also in the comic book market. I mean, for a decade plus, that was the book that you measured all sales by.
It is surprising as well that people were so dismissive, considering that, you know, three, four, five popular Superman movies had happened.
I know. At that time. It's, and also, those movies are not particularly like.
Oh, look at it.
Non-dark. Oh.
Oh,
oh,
whoa.
Hi.
There he is, folks.
The smile.
Hi, Shay.
Multiple New York Times bestselling author.
Yeah.
We can see you. Hi.
I will now introduce a multiple time New York Times bestselling author, creator of the Primo, the. Critically acclaimed Primo program
very
on Amazon
acclaimed.
Freebie, Shay Serrano. Shay, welcome to the program.
Hey.
And today we are talking about The Dark Knight on its 15th anniversary.
Ever heard of it?
Directed by Chris Nolan, starring Christian Bale, Heath Ledger, Aaron Eckhart, Michael Caine, Maggie Gyllenhaal, Gary Oldman, Morgan Freeman, and more. Some quick facts about The Dark Knight. This is the first use of IMAX cameras, The Dark Knight is.
In a feature film.
In a major feature film, not featuring penguins.
or like T-Rexes, yeah. Or, you know, IMAX science.
The casting, maybe not surprising. I think people probably remember this, and also understanding the tenor of the internet, probably this feels right. But Heath Ledger, the casting of Heath Ledger as the Joker was widely reviled early in the process when it was announced. This movie also featured a wildly successful viral marketing campaign.
Mm-hmm. One of the first of its kind that mixed
an ARG, as they call it. I think that it might have been the second one. I think the first one I remember was for Halo 2.
Ah.
I Love Bees. Anybody out there, gamer fans? It was the first comic book movie to break 1 billion.
Nah, that's just
a
casual.
Billy
a
at the
bill.
Box office. A yard, as they say, on the street. And as
is that what they say?
Yeah. And
definitely.
And as Michael Uslan noted in his summary, the lack of nominations for The Dark Knight certainly contributed to the Academy's decision to increase the amount of nominees for their awards. That is The Dark Knight, folks. Let's go around. What's everybody's first memory of seeing The Dark Knight? We'll start with you, Shay, since you're joining us last.
Well, I'm a little thrown off here. When you text me and said, hey, do you want to be on the show? You didn't say Dark Knight. You said, we're doing the second Batman.
Uh-oh. So I came
prepared to talk about Batman Returns.
Like, that's the best Batman movie. I'm okay to flip.
Well, first of all,
five good facts about Batman Returns.
Let me start with one thing first. First of all, absolutely happy to pivot to Batman Returns.
I know, I'm like, actually, it sounds nice.
Two, as always, Shea Serrano is lying about me. I am very happy to show this entire studio audience and everybody on the screen my text with Shea Serrano, who continues to
Photoshop.
Lie about me to wide audiences around the world.
That's my favorite running bit. This started years and years ago. Yeah, like when Jason and I first became buddies, I just started lying about whatever he would tell me. And at the time, between the two of us, it was like 80 people who would see the lies. And now it's like 500,000 people every time you see it. It's a horrible joke. When The Dark Knight came out, I mean, Batman Begins had already come and everybody loved it. We saw that one in the theater. I say we, I'm talking about Laramie, my wife. We were living in Houston at the time. So when The Dark Knight was coming, I was super into it immediately. I think like, especially once the trailer hit and you're like, oh fuck, what are we looking at right here? Like this is, it just looked so cool. And it was, again, it was like an advancement of what they had done in Batman Begins, from my eyes anyways, which was take like this really cool idea and turn it somehow even cooler and make it feel even a little more real and a little more devastating is probably a good word. Like when you watch it and you hear the music, it's just like there's terror around every corner is what it feels like. And it was just so exciting to watch. It was so much fun. Heath Ledger puts on a fucking fireworks show immediately. It's great. It's so great.
Joelle?
Yeah. So in 2008, I was a senior in high school working at a movie theater. I've never told you my Batman origin story. My very first memory is watching Batman the Animated Series with my dad on the couch. So Batman's like deeply ingrained into my personality. I watched Batman the Animated Series like religiously back when it was on Fox. And then when it came to Cartoon Network on reruns, I lived there. and so, you know, having seen all the previous Batman movies and watching them a lot, we had all of them on VHS. I was thrilled when we got Batman Begins and I was like, it's dark and scary. What? That's amazing. I was thrilled. Rewatching it was crazy. Like Scarecrow's in there for like 15 minutes max, probably closer to 8. It was insane how little he's in there, but the impact he has. So when we came to this film, I was studying theater and I was going to be a very serious actress. And Heath Ledger's performance was just, I mean, it's all we could talk about. Like, my drama teacher and I would just sit and talk for hours about, like, what was that thing he did with his mouth? That's before we realized it was because the prosthetics were coming out. And we're like, he's being a snake. Like, he studied snake. And he was ready to go. And
thought he was such an incredible thespian that he, like, scarred his face?
It was real. Just by, like, I didn't realize that he was doing it so they would stick down.
Yeah.
I thought, like, okay, because actors will study an animal and, like, try to imbue and embody the animal. Yeah, yeah. So I was like, snake, that's what he's doing. It's brilliant. and then, yeah, so it became an obsession rather quickly. I think I saw it maybe 5 times in theaters. Loved this movie. Yeah. It was so much fun. Yeah.
I'm so glad you guys have great memories of watching this movie, because it's not I had a bad memory, but I went to see it at a cinema that was now like an award-winning cinema in East London called Genesis. But when I went to see it in 2008, the screen was so fucked up that it was like the size, it looked like it was the size of one of these Zoom screens. And I think we just sat through it. Like, that's the wildest thing. Like, I think we went downstairs, we like bought a hot dog, and we were like, I don't think the projector's working. And they were like, okay, I guess. Cause my memory of it is just on this. So I didn't see it in the cinema in that same big way, but I am the same as you. It's all about Heath Ledger. And I can't believe we never talked about this. My first ever memory is watching Batman 89 on TV at Christmas. In England, they were showing it at Christmas, and I was in my uncle's house. But yeah, I remember just Heath Ledger was really the big thing. And obviously he died before the movie came out. So there was like this huge feeling of wanting to see it and trying to remember him and work out, people, you know, wanted to work out how the performance affected his life. From what everyone said, he just loved doing it. And it was like a lot of fun. It actually wasn't this kind of bummer thing. But yeah, I think Heath's performance is really the thing that I always take away from it. And also the practical effects. I think about them a lot. I think about that. I remember, you know, the IMAX opening. I think that is like the big thing. The Joker's tricked everyone into killing each other. That's like a super chaotic moment. You get that great payoff with the bus where he's like, no, I'm meant to kill the bus driver. Mm-hmm. And the guy's like, what fucking bus? And then the bus just runs him over. Like, so I think that those are definitely my resounding kind of early memories.
I huge comic book nerd, obviously, but I remember.
Really?
I remember Batman Begins. I was working as a cater waiter at that time, and we were doing an event at the Philadelphia Museum. So they bussed us in from Manhattan. And I remember sitting across from one of the waiters who was just saying, have you seen Batman Begins? I was like, no. And he was like, dude, you gotta fucking see it. This is what Batman should have. It was like Michael Uslan's like son or something. This guy was like, so, and I was planning on seeing it, you know, but like money was tight and I was working. And so I was like, okay, I got to go see it. I saw it in the theater. I loved it. And so I was very, very hyped for The Dark Knight. And this is, I don't know how many people remember this, but they showed the IMAX prologue, you know, the heist prologue, the Joker heist, as like a trailer in theaters. But then it got leaked to the internet.
Illegally.
I think someone, filmed the screen and then put it on the internet. And so that's how I first watched The Dark Knight, is I downloaded the LimeWire of the leaked cam and just like very blurrily in like 280p watched that and was like, I'm all the way fucking
You're in. Like, I'm in, baby.
I'm all the way fucking in. And then saw it in the theater and was blown away. And on rewatch, I continue to think that this is not just like obviously a great movie, a great comic book movie, but also kind of, it's so great that it's so much its own thing that you can't do the thing that like Hollywood is built on now, which is create a universe from it, because it is so singularly done.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what makes it so great. I love it so much. One of the things on rewatch that really jumped out to me was there's several like love triangles, if you could call them love triangles. one of them is Bruce, Rachel, and Harvey Dent. Now, here's your timeline. This is a year after Batman Begins, right? Rachel and Bruce have broken up because Bruce is Batmaning and he can't commit, right? they've known each other since they were kids. She was there when he found the Batcave, yada, yada, yada. He loves her, but he can't be with her because Batman reasons. The Dark Knight. Now she's with Harvey Dent. It's been a year. So clearly, like, they've only been together, like, what, 2-3 months?
Yeah, not long. They're he wants to get married. Phase,
and they sure. are
but
so...
But he is trying to get engaged.
Yeah. Bruce still, obviously still in love.
Oh, yeah.
But Harvey and Rachel are so obviously hot and heavy at this mm-hmm. period in time because there's that scene where, you know, Harvey punches the guy who tries to assassinate him in the courtroom, right? He's like, all right, I'll show you combative. And then he punches the guy. And then right after that, Rachel's like, Harvey, let's fucking get out of here.
Look, I just want to say, this is
get out of here,
dude,
bro.
This is a very important moment for Rachel because we do not learn a lot about her, but we do learn that she loves unhinged men.
She loves crazy guys.
This man punched a guy with a gun, and she's like, "Oh, baby, I love it." And
he's like,
the other part of the love triangle is Batman.
So right.
We know her type. Deranged.
So can we just, because like obviously Rachel, we lose her in this film, but I just want to spotlight what a crazy love life she is currently having in this film, getting clearly buck wild with Harvey Dent at
Two-Face.
And she deserves.
She deserves
she
it.
She fucking deserves. Because she has such a glow up from Begins to here. And nothing to do with Katie Holmes. Like I think if you watch the choices Katie Holmes makes, she plays like the girl next door best friend, and that's definitely how Rachel starts off. When we get the new one, Maggie Gyllenhaal, when she comes in, she's like such a boss bitch.
She's a badass, such a lawyer.
Like she's like bossing people around, like in their face, in a way where you would be like, "Yes, ma'am," immediately. Like you would not question what the fuck Rachel was talking about.
Secretary all over again.
And I really think like something happened in that year where she finds herself. She's like, you know what? Screw this. Like I'm totally
powerful. Do you know what I'm telling you? Let's look at
the
Occam's razor. She leaves Bruce, and then suddenly she's kind of living a good life.
And Harvey, great looking guy.
Yeah, Aaron.
Very smart.
He's on his way to being mayor, clearly, like some kind of high official, like. She's doing it, and I'm proud of her. And I really feel like, for like on a comic book scale, like Lois Lane's kind of like the iconic girlfriend of comic books, right? Like she's her own person. She's like a quippy individual who's like very capable. And I really feel like outside of the Superman Lois Lane kind of relationship, this is the first time I see like a girlfriend in a comic book movie where I'm like, I would totally want to be her. Like she's so cool and funny, and
she has a job.
She's not
has a
great afraid job. Of anything. She's awesome. I love Rachel. Shout out to her.
Yeah, I love that moment when after Harvey almost gets killed, and then she's like, not even. Like, he has to be like, yeah, I'm fine, by the way. And she's just like, oh, this is fucking great.
She's like,
they're trying to kill you.
No, I was saying,
oh my God, Harvey, by the way, I am kind of like, I had a call and that's it. I'm done for the day. If you want to.
She understands Gotham better than Harvey or Bruce. She's like, you're the DA in Gotham. If they're not shooting at you, you're not doing your job. I'm like, she knows. That's the politics.
And she's the first person to stand up to the Joker at the party.
Yeah, like that's actually a really great moment.
Yeah.
I feel like she doesn't necessarily get a lot of interior character work, which is kind of the most of Nolan's characters, actually, no matter what gender they are. It's all about their mission is what drives them. But like, that's a great moment where you get to see why Bruce and Harvey like fall for her. You know, she's the person who will stand up to him in that space, even when he's got a knife and he's telling his stories.
Shay, who's the better boyfriend, Harvey or Bruce? Like, who's the better relationship partner, you think?
Bruce, Batman. As soon as stuff went bad for Harvey, like a little bit bad, he just became the worst guy.
He just flipped. He did. He was immediately flipped.
Like immediately.
He has one heated conversation with the Joker. He's like, fuck it, kill everybody.
Yeah. He talked to the Joker for 30 seconds. It was like, all right, I'm going to shoot this kid in the head. I'm going to flip a coin and shoot this kid in the head. That's what he did.
No, that is absolutely true, especially because Harvey, as all great Batman villains, they kind of do like the reflection of Bruce.
Yeah.
And literally, Harvey Dent loses one person and turns into a villain. Bruce doesn't. He loses one person and turns into a sociopathic vigilante hero.
Talk about the reflection of Bruce, because I love this framing.
Okay, so I think this is one of the things for me that doesn't hit as hard as some of the other Batman movies. I think that a great villain is like a reflection of Bruce or a different version of Bruce, right? Batman Returns, the Penguin, he is, what if Bruce's parents abandoned him mm-hmm. instead of died? What if you were really wealthy and you lost everything, you didn't have the kind of, the Joker is like the antithesis of Bruce, where it's, what if you didn't have a mission and your only mission was just to destroy things, right? And then the Riddler in the new, the Batman, Matt Reeves the Batman, that is a really direct reflection of Bruce, where you have, what if you were really an orphan? Now, Bruce is an orphan, but Bruce has billions of dollars. Bruce wasn't raised in an orphanage. Bruce had somebody who loved him in Alfred, you know? The Joker in the original Batman 89, you know, he kills his father figure, and whereas Bruce is killed, you know? I think that that's really cool. And I think with Harvey, they do this really interesting starting point, the White Knight versus the Dark Knight. It's he is going to be the hero mm-hmm. that Gotham can be in an integral way, in a way that's about morality. But then when it comes to that moment of trauma, he just flips. It's like, he Rachel really dies and just he's just flip. Like, boom, I'm going to kill a kid.
Now, I will say, they do, they put stuff in there, clearly, to make you, okay, Harvey's in a lot of pain, half his face got burned off. You mentioned it's
Let's
because,
talk about this moment.
Well, I will get there. But clearly, like, I first want to say, because I did this off mic, and so the audience heard me say this, but the wider streaming audience didn't hear me say this. Batman could have hustled up saving Harvey. Harvey's face is burned because Batman didn't hustle.
They're out of like, the building when it blows up.
He doesn't. And when he catches fire,
he just looks at him.
He doesn't even put his cape over him or
you
anything.
You know that cape is flame retardant.
Yeah,
it
doesn't
definitely.
Do anything. He's just like,
it's
oh,
a
well.
Chemical burn. A cape isn't going to help.
Yeah, no, but like, there's fire on his face.
You don't have a spray. You don't have something in the
spray,
utility
that's what
belt.
I'm saying. I feel like he should.
But he was clearly like, oh, Rachel's boyfriend burned. Up. That's too bad that happened.
Sorry to that man.
Yeah, sorry. And then later he does have like the, but they do put, they mention the intense amount of pain, obviously, that Harvey is in.
He doesn't want to have the skin go off.
Yeah, and then he's like very, very drugged up. So, yes, Harvey does decide to become a supervillain after 5 minutes, but he is like addled. He's not himself. And the Joker's very persuasive.
He's a very persuasive guy. Watching this in a theater without having the history of, like, I didn't read any of the comic books mm-hmm. or know any of this stuff, right? So I'm just watching it for the first time. And there's a point when after he falls into the chemical and he starts getting it on his face, and you're like, wait a second. Hold on a second. And then the big explosion happens and his face gets burned. And then realizing in the theater that Harvey Dent was Two-Face, it'd be like, no fucking way. Oh my God.
The joy of discovery.
Yeah.
It was so much fun when that happened. I couldn't believe it. I was like the Leonardo DiCaprio meme of pointing at the
It's Two-Face.
In the theater. Like, oh my God. It was incredible.
Rosie,
what a great turn.
Talk about that moment where... Okay. Where Harvey, yeah.
So this is one of the funniest. I think the Joker stuff in the hospital and the Joker in the nurse's costume, that to me is like some of the most inherently camp moments from this movie, which I wish there was more of because I love that kind of stuff. But there is the one moment that I do think is like all-time great moment. And I will say, you did a great job defending Harvey. Even though he's a judge, he can defend him. He's a DA, he can defend himself. But still, you did a great, he's addled, you know. But there is that great moment where... The Joker's wearing the nurse's mask. And you can see it's the Joker. They're like,
very clearly.
Then, and Harvey's looking like, oh, this nice nurse is there. And then he takes off the mask and he's like, hey! That is like, I'm so happy to every single person at Warner Brothers, Christopher Nolan, you know, everyone who watched that movie and kept that moment in. Thank you. Because that is just joyful. And I do think that that's one of the coolest moments. I love the moment when the Joker leaves the hospital and the final charge doesn't go off. And he's just kind of like looking at it. There's so much tension. And then when it blows up, he's even shocked. That's such a good character moment.
That moment is improv.
Yeah. I was going to say it was, right? It was to do with the actual charge
the
being delayed.
Was late and they only had one take, so he couldn't drop character and ask what was going on. So he just played it out.
It's so good. And it feels... to me, Jason, actually, I'm going to ask you something because this leads into it. That's the one moment where I truly believe that that anarchist agent of chaos, like he doesn't have everything planned. Because as we were saying while everyone was coming in, this man, for someone who doesn't have a plan, very good at planning.
The logistics is incredible. Like where it guns and ammo for the henchmen.
The school buses.
I mean, he's got to use like 20 miles of rope, like the explosives, the
you
tailored.
You don't have to put your hand up. Just add to
the
add
tailored suits. Like he's got a lot of stuff.
Have you guys heard the Patton Oswalt theory about this movie, about Joker's origin story?
Mm-mm.
Okay, I'm going to try not to butcher it. So, so frequently Joker talks about how he got his scars.
Yeah.
And so we learn through the different tellings that he's an unreliable narrator.
Yeah.
When he's at Harvey's bed, and Harvey calls him some version of crazy, and he's like, dude, if a soldier blows up and mm-hmm. IUD shreds him, nobody thinks that's crazy. That's just the way the world's supposed to work.
Yeah.
Oswald's theory is that he's a soldier. Mm. Who was trained in interrogation methods. When Batman and him have the great interrogation scene, Batman punches him in the face. He's like, you never start with the face.
People get confused.
So the theory then goes, and if you look at the logistics, as you were explaining, and how everything is perfectly calculated in time, and if you think about it as a mirror,
mm-hmm.
and you think about how Batman uses all these military techs to become the superhero that he is, it makes a lot of sense that the Joker was formerly a soldier.
Also, that makes a lot of sense if we talk about the political landscape of when the movie came out. Yeah. To actually have like a disgruntled vet as your main lead would probably have been too kind of radical or shocking then.
Yeah, yeah.
But actually, it's incredibly prescient if you talk about it in that context.
Yeah, and I don't ever want to know for sure. Like, I hate when they're like, and this is why he became the Joker. Yeah. Screw that.
Well,
why?
Like when like, Gary Oldman tells him that the name Two-Face is what they used to call him in Infernal Affairs.
Exactly. I don't need an origin story, but it's fun to be like, oh, is this the one time he's telling the truth?
I love the changing narratives because it's such a nice nod to the comic books where the Joker's origin always changes. So I think that I love that theory. Thank you for that one. That's really cool.
Thanks, Patton Oswalt. If you're
I love, obviously, Heath is incredible.
Unbelievable.
But I love the way they take Joker's very, you know, again, for a guy who says he doesn't plan, his plans are extremely elaborate and very, very crazy. Like, they have the texture of, like, improv comedy where it's like, mm-hmm. Then this will happen. And yes, then I will do this. I always think about the Joker fish storyline from the comics, which is to me the classic crazy Joker scheme. So just to summarize, the Joker puts drugs into the lake that mutate the fish so that they have his face. And he has gone and trademarked his face.
Very smart.
Right. Very, very. So his plan is to bankrupt the seafood industry by suing it
for trademark infringement
for using his face, and therefore Gotham will starve and whatever, he'll ask for $1 million and then he'll rescind the trademark violation. And
I gotta start reading these comic books.
Yeah.
And these plans like have that kind of feel to like the bus coming through the wall mm-hmm. where it's like, and then the bus will come through and that's what kills the final guy.
And the idea
the
of
cigar
like,
grenade that's not a, it's like just a smoke grenade. It could blow him out, but it doesn't. And then I'll hook it up to the thing. Like all these kind of like elaborate bits and schemes and the grenades inside mm-hmm. the vest. All of that stuff is so very, very Jokerish, but heightened to this like horror level.
Yeah.
Disappearing the pencil.
Yes.
Shay, that's one of my favorite scenes. It's so good. Shay, as someone who hasn't read the comics, how did it feel to see like Heath Ledger as the Joker compared to like other Jokers that you'd seen in like previous, you talked about, you know, Batman Returns. So you'd seen Batman 89. Like what did it feel like just as someone who discovered these characters through the films to see like such a different interpretation?
It felt like immediately that was the best villain I'd seen in a movie and like, probably since Hannibal Lecter is what it mm-hmm. felt like. Like that was the first person I thought of when I watched that. I was like, holy shit, this is just, it was so much fun watching him do it. You get like, you get pieces of that sometimes in a performance. Like I think another example of like a small one of that happening, Christian Bale did it at the beginning of The Fighter mm-hmm. when he's sitting on the couch with Mark Wahlberg and they're doing their interview, their thing. And Christian Bale just takes over the whole moment. And you're like, oh, like he's seven levels higher than what Mark Wahlberg can do in that moment. You watch it happen. And then in this movie, Heath Ledger shows up, and he's seven levels past what Christian Bale could. I think Christian Bale is the best Batman we've ever had. Heath Ledger just, he's, it's like almost impossible to describe how good he is. You just have to watch, you have to just say, just look at this, just watch this moment. Watch what's about to happen right here. Watch how he says this word. Watch how he, when the guy calls him crazy and he says, no, I'm not. And then he reinforces it.
The little like tongue click. He does
it. Yeah, no, I'm not. It, like just a little stuff like that. Like what is happening right now? I've never seen anything like this. It was unbelievable watching. It's still my he's my favorite superhero villain. This is my favorite superhero movie, largely because of him. It's just, he's so incredible in this.
I completely agree. My favorite little Joker tick is when he first comes in, you know, all the criminals are meeting because Lau took their money to Hong Kong. And he comes in, he goes, ha, he, ha, ho, ha.
Yeah. Like he's working out the law. He's like workshopping it.
Something I noticed about this movie on rewatch, I hadn't thought too much about previously, is, isn't the takeaway from the end of this movie that Batman has kind of not figured out the dog problem? Like, he gets fucked up by the dogs early.
At the beginning.
Right? And then he's like, okay, I need a lighter suit because, like, I got knocked off the van, the whole thing. But now he's even more susceptible to the dogs. Like, Joker almost takes him out.
With dogs.
With dogs.
He does punch a dog down an elevator shaft.
Yes, he does.
That is a thing that happens in this movie. But you're right. Also, I will say, on watching this, now this is the problem when you watch this stuff so much, yeah? The end of the movie, you have Harvey Dent, the one time, you know, white knight of Gotham, right, who goes crazy because of Rachel dying, and he talks to the Joker. And then you have the Joker. Batman won't kill the Joker, but right, he will kill Harvey Dent, and he kills Harvey Dent. I feel like that's a moral complexity that I'm still trying to work it out. I know he kills him to save a kid, but if you kill the Joker, surely you're saving everyone else from all the inevitable crimes the Joker's going to commit in the future.
But he's in love with the Joker.
Exactly.
He can never get rid of him.
No, no, no. Okay.
That is.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I will actually say, I never really realized it until I watched it this time. But Heath actually does play that in the script, assuming is Goya, because he's really the comic book guy. Yeah. They play into it where he's constantly telling Batman, like, I'm not going to hurt you because I care about you and I need you. Yeah. Now, Batman has not come to that realization yet, but you could argue the fact that he doesn't kill him is because on some level he does understand that, which is the inherent thing that happens in the comics.
There's a wonderful moment when the Joker is falling, right? After they have their, you know, he
gets bitten by a dog.
Yeah, he gets bitten by the dog, and now the Joker has him, but then he shoots the batarangs out of the
dog. I know how you got these scars.
Wow, Bruce, what a comeback. And then the Joker's falling. And the Joker is elated because he's like, ha, I got you, I won. You are going to murder me right now. Ha, ha. I have beat you. And
I
then
corrupted you.
I corrupted you. And then when he saves him, he's like legitimately disappointed.
He is, but I think there's a romance in it because he also says, he's like, you just couldn't let me go.
Yeah.
And that's like a throwback to when Bruce tells him to let Rachel go. Also, I will say, another thing that I was kind of think is a really good bittersweet, sad ending of this movie, Joker says you're incorruptible because he won't kill him, but they end up corrupting Batman because he covers up the truth about what Harvey did, and he does it because it's the right reason, but then you get a corrupted Batman. I thought that was pretty powerful at the end of this.
Is that the best? Like, can't you just say, I don't know, one of the Joker's henchmen?
There's like 50,000 options.
Yeah, there's so many of them running around town, and one of them pushed Harvey off the thing. And,
not just that, but like, there's like a million criminals in Gotham. They literally had to build Arkham because there's so many. The Scarecrow is still active. There are a lot of different ways. On a narrative level, I feel like I understand the messaging.
Let somebody else who's living take the fall. I'm sure many people died and they could have been like, it was that one. He's dead. Who cares?
What about one of the many corrupt cops that they just kept hiring?
Yeah, I mean, it's not sure. Like, what is it going to be tough for Commissioner Gordon to lie under oath? They're all lying. Harvey tells you, like, your entire unit is racketeers.
Horrible. I know, to the point where you had to fake your own death, Harvey. Like, it's pretty bad out here.
I think, like,
Can I offer
yes,
an alternate origin story for the Joker?
Oh, okay, I'm ready.
This is opposite of the Patton Oswalt one. because this is a thing that stood out to me when I watched it on this time. You know the moment when the mayor is in the office talking and then the fake Batman who's been hung
swings down,
bangs into the great moment. They lower his body down and it's got the card
good
on there.
Good horror shock.
On the card that the Joker has given him, it says, "Will the real Batman please stand up?"
It does.
This is 2008. In 2000, Eminem put the song out where I think the Joker just got super into Eminem and then smacked.
Believable.
I got it.
And that's why we
got it. Oh, he's a Batman stan.
No. He is Stan.
What if
the Joker is Stan? It's actually Devin Sawyer playing Heath Ledger playing the Joker. Yeah. I believe it.
A small geopolitical question.
Just a small. There's a few that this.
Just a doubt.
I mean, yeah, and obviously, like the spots. Involvement, like you know, China Panic is kind of like a sub theme of this movie, right? Harvey at one point says, you know, carbon fiber, 9mm. If you're going to assassinate a public servant, I suggest you buy American, right?
He does, yeah.
not, of course, not realizing that like. Batman sources all his fucking batarangs from China. Like,
China.
All that shit comes from China. Did Batman not almost start World War III kidnapping Lao?
Don't even get me started yet. So this man is essentially, from what we see, he's like Bruce Wayne in Hong Kong. He has billions of dollars.
Yeah.
He has high, you know, skyscrapers. He has people who work for him. And Bruce just went there, kidnapped him, put a parachute on him, arrested him in America with no jurisdiction. And everyone was just like,
that's fine. Multiple people know it's Batman. Like, people saw.
And there's no lawyer who comes to get him out. They just leave him in, like, not county, but in, like, the police.
And there's
jail.
No stealth on that plane. Easily trackable.
Like, you're telling, like, this would be. You'd turn on CNN and it would be like
everywhere.
China recalls their ambassadors because of Batman international incident.
It
would be a fucking deal.
He would be out of that prison so quickly. Like you couldn't even believe it. Like he would never have been there overnight. Absolutely.
Do they
almost
talk about
World War III?
Do they talk about in the comic books like how famous Batman is?
Yeah,
it depends. The version, in some places, there's versions of him around the world and he's inspired different heroes or he licenses himself out to different countries and like different people play him in different countries. That's real. But there is also an argument that nobody would know who he was in this more like grounded world. So somebody would just be like, oh no, this guy was kidnapped. But also I feel like they would then look for him, maybe.
Because it seems like somebody would have been like, oh shit, it's Batman. Like somebody would have said that. You know what I mean? But they didn't. So I'm like, maybe they don't know who this guy is.
This brings up one of the things I think that's really interesting about these movies and actually is one of its most unexpected legacies. One of the big discourses we all have, right? If you talk about Batman. Why doesn't Batman put money into Gotham? Why doesn't Batman just like open an orphanage? In some versions, he has. Why doesn't Batman just like not go out and beat up poor people who are suffering from the fact that he's a billionaire?
He does have the orphanage and the Dark Knight Rises that gets defunded and he didn't know about it.
But like, I actually think that Batman Begins and the Dark Knight, they bring those questions to the forefront of pop culture conversation, because if you place these stories in a real world, as this does, this hyper-realistic world, then people are obviously going to say, well, wouldn't there be a geopolitical fallout? Like if we're talking about the DA or we're talking about a militarized vehicle, like me, Jason, you were talking about this earlier, but like you don't think the guy who like designed the Tumblr who's sitting like, in somebody, he's like, oh shit, I designed that car. Wait a minute. And like, wouldn't everyone assume that in a city, you know, we were kind of talking about this off mic, but like in a city like Gotham, where so many people are poor and so many people are struggling and one guy is a billionaire, wouldn't you be like, I wonder who has the money for all this militarized tech and who has the time and doesn't have to do anything.
This reminds me of The Dark Knight Returns. There's a moment where a guy is trying to blackmail Batman via Lucius Fox. And he's
Not just that, but as me and Jason were saying, there is like 25 different plot lines in this movie. The lawyer who's trying to blackmail him.
Right. And so like he's part of the company and Lucius laughs in his face. He's like, so you think that a billionaire who dresses up as a bat and punches crazy folks in the middle of the night you're going to blackmail him?
Good luck.
Good luck. And I really feel like multiple people in Gotham are just playing along.
There's people who know. This is an important question that Jason posed in our ideas for the show. How many people know?
But haven't said anything. Well, clearly the guy who built
40.
The Tumblr.
At least 40. I agree. At least 40.
Everybody at the factory who makes the Batarangs. Who are these for?
Why do they say BW? If you turn that upside down, it's like a B and an M.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, you know, everybody who had seen the original bat armor prototype, you know, for the military.
Who are the all the security guards who watch the tapes of him coming in, and I'd be like, how did he leave the building?
Yes.
Mr. Wayne has to be here because we did not see him physically leave.
Are the mechanics who are fixing the bat tumbler, the bat bike? Like, surely they must know, because it's not just Bruce and Lucius. No way.
A lot of people. All the household staff at Wayne Manor.
Yeah, the
motorcycle
is one of my favorite vehicle designs.
Absolutely.
So dope. You know what I really like about this movie, that when Jason asked about doing this thing, I'm like, let me rewatch it because it's been like 2 years since I saw it. Mm-hmm. And then I watched it like four times over. It was so good. But each time I watched it, the thing that stood out to me was how many times in the movie they do a thing of like, no, we're good. And then immediately they're not good. It's so much fun. They have the meeting. And the one guy in there, I think he's like a cop, and he's like, "No more dead cops!
No more dead cops!" Cheers.
And then, like 10 seconds later, the cop gets shot in the face by the Joker.
And
they do that so many times throughout the movie, when the Joker is like trying to get Harvey Dent in the thing, and they shoot at him, and he goes, "Don't worry, he's gonna need something much bigger than that to get
in
here."
And he pulls out the bazooka.
And then immediately a bazooka.
when Batman is
cruising through, and they're like, "Oh, he missed." And then immediately the truck flips upside down. Like, they do it like 10 times in there.
You
and it gets funnier every single time.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
I don't know if you heard that, but that's like before the cop guy.
Yeah.
And someone yells, "Things are worse than ever." And it's like, you're right. To Harvey's credit,
it's true.
You're right. It's true. I think that's actually one of the really cool things I mentioned before, how you kind of can't do a shared universe off of this. And one of the reasons why is it never gets better. Like, Bruce gets a happy ending at the very end of the series, but like a nuclear bomb does go off.
And you could argue it's like a dream ending.
You know, and like they lose an entire city for like almost a year with, 50,000 public servants living in tunnels.
And the only person to protect them is like Cop Robin.
Yeah, it's bad. That one of the things that really creates the texture of this series and The Dark Knight in particular is like it just gets worse the whole time.
No, it's true, and even
everything gets it just gets worse and worse and worse the more bad stuff happens.
No, it's true, and if you actually think about it, like the trajectory of The Dark Knight Rises is like, yeah, he gets like a maybe happy ending where Alfred like sees him in Italy and maybe that happened and maybe it didn't. But like he's just fallen in love with Talia al Ghul, spoiler alert. And and he's like in love with her and everything. And then she just has like the worst on-screen death. So it's like even his happy ending is tragic. It's like it's not settling, but it's like it's a different version of what he thought his life would be. He'd found this person who'd had this tragic origin the same way as him, you know? So even then, it's like you said, everything just gets worse. And something that I think they do really well. Also, Shay, I just have to say, you need to read the comics, because that thing of being like, this thing could never happen, and then you turn the page and that thing happens, it's like one of the most joyful things. And they absolutely took it from that. But like, it's that thing of like, everything bad that happens in these movies happens because of Batman. And I actually think that they did that on purpose. Like, I was watching the making of, you can watch it on YouTube if you don't have the Blu-ray or DVD, but like the making of, they talk about how from the very first movie, even though they didn't know it was going to be a franchise, allegedly, I'm like, it's Batman, guys. I think you knew, but sure. Like, they basically say they always knew that if the Joker arrived, it's because of Batman, right? Batman creates the Joker because the Joker sees Batman and decides he needs to exist. And I like the way that they keep that throughout. Like, the death of Harvey Dent and the way it's treated and the cover-up, that leads to Bane. And it's this completely depressed. He's here. He's entered the building. And that's kind of that depressing, like, ripple effect of that movie is just like, Batman's trying to do his best, but everything he does just inherently makes the city worse. And that is kind of the lore of Batman. But it's also one of the things I like the most about the Batman, like the most recent one, is it has this kind of ending where Batman realizes that he can actually, like, help people. And it seems like maybe there's a little bit of hope. Whereas this one's like, Batman, you have to take the fall for 5 murders you didn't do and drive off and like live in your big house as like a cool reclusive billionaire. But that's not bad because you've got $1 billion. So he's doing okay.
A final quick question. Rank for me in from best to worst smelling the Batman villains from the Dark Knight trilogy. Oof. Ra's al Ghul, Scarecrow, the Joker, Bane.
Okay, I got this.
Okay.
All right.
The expert.
Scarecrow smells the best because he's a doctor and he has to get through his day. And
okay, that makes
he's
sense.
Got, and like, he has to wear the mask.
Right, exactly. So he's got to show up fresh to work every day. Otherwise, people are going to start asking questions.
He might not take his nightmare LSD drug if he smells bad.
It's Joker, Bane, and who else?
Joker, Bane, Ra's al Ghul, yeah.
Okay. Oh, man. I think Bane, because he's really about presentation and he's leading like
his head's looking shiny.
You know? Yeah. And I think, you know, he's keeping everybody sort of in lock. He's got like, he's wearing masks before any of us. I really feel strongly that he was on his germ shit. He knew and he was prepared. Okay, then I'm going to go. The last two are situational, right? Because you would expect the Joker because he's wild and his face is all greasy. So
his hair's
he's not
greasy.
Walking in regularly. But if we're in the caves in the mountains, and Ra's al Ghul probably stinking up a lot. Like he's out there like fighting and pretending to be other people and telling the lies. I think that there might be at times comparisons to B.O. between the Joker and Ra's al Ghul.
Never trust
There's
your
no
eyes,
no way.
Bruce. Trust
the, the Joker's. The Joker smells so bad.
I agree. You can tell by his teeth.
You could tell by his teeth because his teeth are super caked up.
Well, that's true. Like, that's true.
You can see when man.
You can see when he grabs Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont that Leahy is getting kicked in the face by what is emanating from the mouth of the Joker.
Yeah,
Rosie, do you have a? Do
no, I think you guys summed it up. I think the Joker smells the worst. Definitely, his hair looks like he hasn't had a shower for like 50 years.
Yeah.
The suit he probably only has one. Let's be real. Like it's a bad time. I wouldn't like to be around him. That would actually be my biggest issue being around him.
I think Ross.
Otherwise, I'd be fine.
I agree that I agree. Scarecrow smells the best because he does have a day job. Mm-hmm. I think Ross smells like incense or something like that.
Probably.
You know, like, you're just like,
yeah.
Oh, he's here. Bane, it's interesting. Bane, I think, just smells like
Axe body spray.
Like a body. Yeah, like
he
a body.
He smells like 24-hour fitness.
Yeah, he just smells like... he's never wearing a shirt. Like, he's down there. When they take Gordon down there, he's just like... They take him to see Bane, and Bane's just like on his haunches with no shirt on.
Wearing
like, what is he even doing? He's just like crouching with no shirt, okay? And then, obviously, I think the Joker smells like a bag of pennies. Like, smells awful. That's it for our show. A big thank you to Michael Uslan, Shay Serrano, Joelle Monique.
Woo!
Big thank you to you, to everybody who's streaming. Catch the next episode of X-Ray Vision Wednesday, June 30th. X-Ray Vision is a Crooked Media production. The show is produced by Chris Lord and Saul Rubin and executive produced by me, Jason Concepcion. Our editing and sound design is by Vasilis Fotopoulos. Video production by Dylan Villanueva and Rachel Gajewski. Social media by Awa Okolati and Caroline Dunphy. Thank you to Brian Vasquez for our theme music. See you next time.
See you next time. Woo!
Hey, guys. Back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah.
and some waves so we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between Leesa and West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is expertly crafted from natural latex, natural wool, and certified safe foams to elevate your sleep sanctuary and support a greener tomorrow. Plus, every purchase helps fuel Leesa's work with shelters and those in need. Don't put off a good night's sleep any longer. Get a Leesa mattress today for a sound sleep tonight. Visit leesa.com/iHeart. That's leesa.com/iHeart.